Appellant, State of Wisconsin. The pertinent procedural facts are these. The State filed an interlocutory appeal following the decision and order of the Walworth County Circuit Court, which denied the State's use of the contents of a pre-sentence defense memoranda. The Court of Appeals certified the appeal to this Court for its determination and review. This Court should reverse the decision and order of the Walworth County Circuit Court, wherein the Court found that the protections of Wisconsin Statute 97215 and this Court's holding in State v. Kroll applies to defense pre-sentence memoranda for three reasons. One, the decision is not supported by statute or case law, thus protections of defense pre-sentence memoranda is a legislative issue. Two, the three constitutional due process rights afforded to criminal defendants at sentencing to be present and to be afforded the right to allocution, to be represented by counsel, and to be sentenced on the basis of true and accurate information are all protected by established Wisconsin precedent and the current application of 97215. And three, an extension of confidentiality protections is not warranted by public policy due to the fact that defendants may fully and freely express all information that would be pertinent to a sentencing court in the PSI interview. The plain language of 97215 does not apply to alternate forms of pre-sentence reports. As the Court of Appeals aptly noted in the certification at page 7, Wisconsin Statute 97215 was enacted before defendants began supplying sentencing courts with their own privately obtained pre-sentence memoranda. Therefore, it's obvious that the legislature did not intend to define and protect a document that did not exist. The statute's plain language further confirms this point when applied to the defense pre-sentence memoranda that exists today. Mr. Grieve would have this court to conclude that the whole of the statute, meaning its core purpose, is greater than the sum of the statute's parts and subsections, while forgetting that in construing or interpreting a statute, the entire section and related sections are to be considered in its construction or interpretation. Therefore, 97215 sub 4 on confidentiality of the PSI can't be conferred in absence of the remaining subsections. Looking to 97215(1), the court may order the pre-sentence investigation after a conviction. No other entity is authorized to order an investigation or conduct an investigation. Therefore, if the statute applied to defense memoranda, they would be court-ordered, and the defense would not have the authority to determine whether or not to conduct an investigation as it now stands. Sub 1 also states, as Mr. Grieve notes, that only in felony cases that the court orders a DOC employee to conduct the investigation. This, however, does not mean that the defense is one of the other entities that the court may order to conduct an investigation, and there is nothing in either statute or case law that suggests that any other entity than the DOC has been ordered, although the state concedes that's a possibility.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I mean, let's say you have a judge that says, okay, I'm going to order a pre-sentence, the normal pre-sentence formula. You know, it's prepared by an employee of the department and who conducts it. But the public defender says, hey, Judge, we have someone on staff that's doing our pre-sentence reports, and I'm of the opinion that the more information you get, the better. And I think you're of that opinion too, Judge. I mean, what's more information going to do, be harmful or helpful? And the judge says, you're right. And he says, well, you issue an order. I hereby issue an order authorizing that the state public defender may present a pre-sentence report at the sentencing. Now, what do you say about that?
That wouldn't change the issue presented before the court now, because it's an undisputed fact that this pre-sentence memoranda was not court-ordered. And in the event that a court would order any entity to present a PSI, it would be subject to all of the regulations and accountability that is found within the statute, whereas this one was not.
Including the confidentiality.
Including the confidentiality.
Well, if the local public defender can get a court to issue such an order, then it's your position all of this, all of the statutory provisions set forth in 972.15 would be triggered by that order or all the relevant ones?
Under the scenario presented, yes.
Okay. But could I ask a question? Why does the state want this evidence?
Well, it's actually very pertinent to the issue that's being presented at trial, the sexual assault charge, wherein the defendant admitted to sexual acts involving the crime presented and to other acts. So it's definitely pertinent to the issue that will be tried.
But the state was prepared to go to trial originally without this evidence.
Definitely, but now we have an admission of a party opponent, and it's definitely relevant to the issue before the court.
Well, I mean, certainly it's relevant. I can't dispute that. But what are the deleterious consequences that would flow from suppressing the statement as a general rule?
It would deny the state pertinent evidence that otherwise would not be available to it, because the PSI, per 972.15, is sealed and protected. So any information that would be in that document would not be available to the state on retrial.
Would the use of the private PSI in any way affect what kind of proof the state might make? And what I'm thinking of, it would it in any way support the state's not calling the victim for a second trial or for a trial?
That certainly in this case would be true when you have admissions by the defendant in the memoranda.
So
this act and to other acts.
Depends kind of on what is in it as to how far its usefulness can be taken.
Definitely.
Okay. Let me ask this. If someone enters a plea of guilty and there is a full plea colloquy, but they've entered that plea with the understanding that they have a right to appeal, oh, say, a search and seizure issue or something, and it goes back. I don't think that the plea colloquy can come in and be used in a subsequent trial. Isn't that right?
That's correct. Per Wisconsin Statute 90410, admission is barred of evidence at a subsequent proceeding of any plea, the information from the plea colloquy.
Okay. And clearly, we understand that in a regular pre-sentence investigation, statements made in that cannot be used in a subsequent trial. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. Now, the policy that is embodied in those two statutes, why doesn't that just kind of slip over and cover these facts?
It's inappropriate to cover the facts of this case with those statutes because the pre-sentence investigation and the pre-sentence memo are more than two documents by the parties that have this distinction with no substantive difference. The differences are very substantive. The PSI by regulation is to be neutral and objective. No such mandate exists for the defense pre-sentence memoranda. Who conducts the memoranda investigation is not regulated as it is with the PSI. The DSM is an advocacy document whose goal is to mitigate the resulting sentence, whereas the goal of the PSI, the state statutory goal, is to provide the court with full and relevant information. And defense expert Marcia Sheen's article on pre-sentence memoranda by defense, it's advised to defendants that they should leave out anything that would be too damaging to their goal of mitigating their sentences. And so, therefore, the documents in their essence are not the same, and their core purpose is not the same. It's a tool of advocacy at sentencing. It's part of the three-pronged strategy at sentencing to have the defendant allocute, the defense attorney propose a sentence, and then to solidify that with the written document, the pre-sentence memoranda.
How often is this used?
As the Court of Appeals noted, that is more and more common that defendants will submit their own pre-sentence memoranda. I don't have numbers on the actual use, but it's becoming more and more common. They present their own psychological reports, sometimes letters in support of the defendant's proposed sentence. All of these things are different forms of the memo.
It may be different forms, but that's not one where there's going to be an admission, several of those that you mentioned.
In the psychological evaluation, there's a potential for that. Letters in support, no, because that would be from family and friends who support the defendant's proposed sentence. However, in looking at it globally, adding the memo to 972.15 is an issue properly left to the legislature. Because as I stated, and as 972.15 reveals, the terms PSI report and defense memo are more than party identification markers for documents. The distinctions represent substantive differences. As I said, the PSI author is acting exclusively on behalf of the independent judiciary and not as an agent of either party per Perez at 170 Wisconsin 2nd 141. And second of all, the integrity of the sentencing process demands that the PSI report be accurate, reliable, and above all objective. No such requirement is placed upon the memoranda. The defense pre-sentence memoranda, as I said, is an advocacy document whose goal is to mitigate the sentence. If the defense pre-sentence memoranda were designed to purely to assist the court in reaching an appropriate sentence, it would be reasonable to expect that at least in some instances the memoranda author would recommend a sentence that was harsher than that recommended in the pre-sentence investigation report. And to my knowledge, that does not happen. Therefore, in spite of the labels and the substantive difference in the documents, the legislature has not saw fit to amend the statute to include the defense sentence memoranda. And this court, per State versus Hall, does not rewrite statutes to achieve a result, even a desired result. In that case, dealt with an unconstitutional statute, and it should be even more applicable where we have a statute that is constitutional and presents no due process violation.
If we should agree with you, Ms. Campbell, in effect, won't this stifle such advocacy proceedings or such advocacy memoranda?
Actually, it would not. It would just place the defendant upon notice that the statements that he submits in this document become part of the public record and may be used in the event of retrial after successful appeal. And it doesn't stifle the defendant's ability to present any and all information that he would desire to the sentencing court, because every statement that he makes in the PSI investigation is protected by the current system. Therefore, this issue is actually a diversion, because the system as it exists functions well. You have the right to allocute, which is not compromised, right to speak to the court, to be represented, and the right to be sentenced based upon true and accurate information. None of those due process rights are compromised by the current system. Therefore, there is no need to extend confidentiality protections to the defense pre-sentence memoranda, because everything that Mr. Grieve says he wants to accomplish is already accomplished in the current system.
These defense pre-sentence memoranda are typically submitted as part of the public record and contained in the public court file, aren't they? They're not usually.
Yes, they are. We have an atypical situation here where the circuit court did indeed seal the DSM along with the PSI, but that's atypical.
Atypical?
Atypical. It's usually part of the public record, typically.
So do you typically find a admission of guilt?
No, you don't, and that's perhaps why the issue has not come before this court or other courts in our jurisdiction previously.
Would you recommend, if we go your way, that the person be given a Miranda warning or a an adaptation of the Miranda warning so that the person is advised that anything he or she says can be used against him in another trial?
Possibly, but that would also be a legislative issue, whether or not we're going to have this document, which is not a PSI by any of the tenets of the statute, incorporated into the statute and subjected to the accountabilities and the restraints that a PSI is, and then...
How is the state harmed if we would hold against you? Now, in this particular case, it may be a little tougher for you to prove your case, but as Justice Prosser indicated, I mean, the reason you prosecute is you think you can prove the case, right? So how is the state harmed when this, you say, no, you can't use an admission against the defendant? One, you get the defendant theoretically being honest and forthright with his or her own expert witness, in effect. The judge gets it, and the judge is sophisticated enough to know this is an advocacy piece. So whether the defendant says something favorable to himself or unfavorable, it's an advocacy piece. Why are you harmed?
Well, at sentencing, the state is not harmed because they have their own PSI mm-hmm. and the conviction mm-hmm. has already mm-hmm. been achieved. But at retrial on successful appeal and reversal of the conviction, as in this case, the information can be quite crucial.
Maybe crucial, but theoretically you're supposed to have enough information to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, maybe a key witness is gone. I mean, I can see that these things happen. But in this case, you're not alleging any of that, right?
That's very true. But in the general issue still remains that this document is not afforded protections by any existing statute or by case law, and there's no reason to extend the protections when the issue that Mr. Grieve is concerned with, his ability to be sentenced based upon accurate information and full disclosure, is not jeopardized.
Well, it's not jeopardized because you say that the state is going to present a PSI, and that's done on behalf of the state and not on behalf of the prosecutor, right?
Correct.
If that's true, why do you allow this to be introduced anyway? Because it's not worth anything. It's an advocacy piece. The defendant wants to advocate. He can advocate himself by standing up and talking to the judge, or he can have his lawyer do that. So why spend a lot of time and effort, and I assume the public defender's office is spending money, to get these advocacy, maybe not fully trusted unless he says something against his own interest, right?
Well, correct, but it does, the state recognizes that it is a legitimate advocacy piece to have witnesses that might not have been interviewed by the state, other family members, friends, speak on his behalf through the DSM interviews. That's all legitimate. The only issue is whether or not this should be considered for confidentiality purposes to be a PSI when it's not regulated, not neutral, not controlled by the statute in any other respect. If it's just going to be confidential, a defendant may allocute and make any statements he wants. He may have families or friends present. The state has no problem with that. It makes the system more fair by allowing him to present any mitigating statements or interviews or testimony that he may choose to do.
My concern is one of fundamental fairness. Now, I sat on the trial bench for a number of years, and these were just coming into vogue. And I just want to ask, who is doing this? The public defender has either, are they hiring a private entity, or is it someone on their own staff that prepares these? Do you know?
The defense attorney may prepare the memo. However, in many cases, the defendant may be able to afford a privately obtained professional PSI author or an outside third party, but the defense attorney is not prohibited from preparing the PSI, the DSM, for his client.
In the first part of my question was, in fairness, it would seem that any statement, and I don't disagree with the giving the, I'm not sure I'd want to give the same confidentiality, at least under the statute, under 972.15, but just as I think it's, is it fair for after trial's taken place, we're talking about the sentencing itself, and this is a piece, and as I understand this, he made some incriminating statement, okay? But what's wrong with just saying, well, we wouldn't allow that to come in?
Well, it actually is creating a diversion because we already have full protection for the defendant via the PSI interview and the report, which
well,
is
you, seem to, you say that's a neutral. I don't know if it's looked upon, but you're saying one is neutral and the other is an advocacy piece.
Actually, that is also... That's also taken care of by the fact that the defendant receives the PSI before the court considers it, has the opportunity to object to the contents, suggest corrections, and ask for amendments. So that balances the system for the defendant. Therefore, we have no need to extend confidentiality protections in the statute to an alternate document that has no other form of regulation other than their request to make it confidential. Who does it, their objectivity to neutrality is not demanded. That's why, as a matter of fundamental fairness, the confidentiality should not be extended.
These inculpatory statements to the private pre-sentence writer, who, as I understand it, was a social worker, is that right? Or a psychological professional of some sort?
I do believe so. I'll just check the facts.
Not a
Heather Rue, a clinical social worker.
Not a state actor or arm of the prosecution or Department of Corrections or anything like that.
Correct.
And the statements were fully voluntary.
Yes.
Right. And I don't wish to be cynical, but if the defendant were immunized against the use of these statements, either in the state's case in chief or to impeach any testimony that he might give in his own case, he might be more likely to take the witness stand and lie, right?
That's a possibility, and the state submits that a defendant who files a DSM faces a decision. He may seek mitigation of sentence by making inculpatory statements in a memorandum, or he may preserve his privilege against self-incrimination in the event of successful appeal and retrial. By voluntarily making statements in a memoranda instead of in the PSI where he already has protection, the defendant waives or forfeits his right against self-incrimination in that case because he already has a vehicle by which he can fully confess, take responsibility, show express remorse through the PSI interview.
Isn't there likely to be overlap in what the defendant says in the PSI and in the advocacy memorandum? I mean, it would seem to me if you're participating in preparing an advocacy memorandum, you know you're covered in the other document, but you've got to be careful with every word. Otherwise, it might be used against you. That doesn't strike me as encouraging and promoting candor.
Candor is promoted. Again, we have a diversion by the mischaracterization of the document. Candor is already promoted by the current system. You have the defendant shielded from future prosecution based on any statement that he makes to the PSI investigator. So therefore, there is no need other than the fact that the defendants are free to place anything in the record that they think might assist them in mitigating the resulting sentence. There is no need to extend the confidentiality protections to this alternate document when all of that is provided for in the PSI system as it now stands. The system isn't broken and doesn't need any repair or fixing. There is no due process dilemma, only one of creation by the mischaracterization of the document that is not a PSI per the statute.
If a person wanted to do a thorough sentencing memorandum and let's say I'm the defendant, and I've got some substantial mental health problems, and so in my sentencing memorandum, I want my mental health records, and maybe one of the reasons I have mental health problems in part was because I was abused as a child. So let's get those records, too. Those are the kinds of things that oftentimes show or references show in a PSI. If they also show in a document initiated by the defense, the pre-sentence memorandum, they're accorded no confidentiality?
The as it now stands, the defense often does present its own psychological reports and evaluations, and those are also part of the public record after conviction, as it now stands. But the state is not sure as to all the mechanisms for governing those particular reports, other than its own use of those reports in appeal on appeal. I see that my time is up. If there are no further questions.
Ms. Campbell, you'll have 5 minutes in rebuttal, as you know.
Yes.
Jeff De La Rosa, representing Thomas A. Is it Grieve? Grieve.
Well, good afternoon, and may it please the court. I am Jeff De La Rosa, and I represent Thomas Grieve in this particular matter. As I did in the briefs to the appeal court and the briefs to this court, I'm here to urge the court to find that Mr. Grieve's statements and the pre-sentence memorandum of Ms. Rowe be deemed confidential. This case is somewhat special as it comes up to the court after a successful appeal by Mr. Grieve, and I think that that context puts a special imprint upon the case. My argument
is this always going to come up that way?
I'm sorry?
Isn't that always going to come up that way?
In most cases, I would agree. But I think there would be cases that are moving through the trial level, and you might have an evidentiary issue, as we did here, and the state would then pursue permissive appeal, and it could come to the court without having gone through the appeal process first. But I note that here we're of course, here after appeal. The arguments today that I have for you are mainly due process principles and public policy reasoning supporting it. Not because 972.15 isn't necessarily applicable to our situation, but I think there are other overriding concerns that I want to present to the court today. And I start with the statement that sentencing is a pretty critical stage, and really for three reasons. One, it's the culmination of a case. Two, it's probably the first opportunity for a defendant to have true direct one-on-one contact through the court on a substantive manner, where a court can question a defendant as to his or her attitude about the case, the incident that caused the case to come forward, the police, the plea colloquy, and anything else. It's some direct one-on-one contact of a substantive nature. And it's not that that type of contact wouldn't occur earlier in the case through a plea colloquy or where a judge is asking a defendant if he's knowingly waiving the right to remain silent in order to take the stand. But it's in a special context. And then third, there's a shift in the case that we move from focus on a defendant in the pretrial proceedings or at a trial where it's a jury and a defendant, and we're focused on the fact finder, to a shift to the courts because sentence is about to be meted out to a defendant. And that creates, I think, some burdens and requirements both for a defendant and for the court itself.
It seemed to me as I read your brief and listened to this early part of your argument, you're focusing on the defendant's due process rights at the time of sentencing. Why wouldn't the proper focus be on his due process rights at the time of trial in the use of these statements against him?
Well, I think that those were involved. And I did not mean to neglect that particular issue. a defendant's due process rights at sentencing are implicated should the court deem that the sentence, that the, excuse me, the statements are not confidential. Then we have, I think, Miranda issues. Oftentimes, if a defendant is in custody and the pre-sentence investigation by the DOC author is being conducted at a local jail or at a prison, we have a custodial setting. And though not necessarily within the Miranda context, I think that it's fair to say that there is certain feelings of pressure to speak with the pre-sentence investigation report author.
Somebody who's on the defendant's side?
I'm sorry?
Does that same argument hold true when the defendant is, albeit in custody, but not speaking to a state actor, speaking to somebody who is essentially representing the defendant and arguing in mitigation of sentence on his behalf?
I think this,
the whole purpose of a defense pre-sentence and the whole role of a defense pre-sentence writer.
I think the pressure still exists, but to a much lesser degree, only because, and I can only speak from experience, I would believe that defendants are often counseled by their attorneys to speak as freely, as candidly as possible to, in this example, Heather Rowe, who made the report here. So I think that there is some push and pressure on defendants to speak to, if you want to term it, their alternative pre-sentence writers. So sure, I think some pressure still exists.
But not the same sort of pressure that we're talking about in Miranda, in a custodial interrogation setting. That's
correct.
Far different. We're talking about a defendant who's trying to help himself out with his own team, basically, as opposed to, you know, an adversarial interrogation with somebody from the other side.
Sure. That I would agree with the court. However, for a pre-sentence investigation report, an alternative report, to be effective, it has to have some measure of truth and credibility to it. If we're talking about a sexual assault case and a defendant says, I did it, but I didn't mean to do it, it wasn't that big a deal, you know, or some statement that just doesn't fit in with the psychological evaluation that is going on, that's not going to work. You know, or if the author is of such a slant personally that they can't be objective in going through Common Test as a Razor, RRASOR, I'm sure the court is familiar with that test, or the DSM. If the author can't be objective, then oftentimes I think defense counsel are not going to want to use their services. And in my experience, I don't draft them. And I don't know of too many defense attorneys that are doing it. We tend to view pre-sentence memorandum as specialized documentation that take some specialized knowledge, only because in addition to dealing with, say, psychological or mental health issues, we're dealing with substance abuse. And if we're going to want these reports, we're going to want a family or social or medical history, because we're not qualified to determine what level of treatment somebody might need in terms of substance abuse or what particular psychological problems they have that need to be addressed through, for example, prison programming. We're just not qualified to do them. I think they've moved into a specialized field, and there are a number of individuals that whose names you can get. The State Public Defender's Office has a website, and for those of the assigned counsel division, they'll give you a password and you can go into it, and there's a listing of individuals who do different types of assessments, professionals who have been used before by state public defender personnel, their approved personnel, and who are willing to work at the considerably decreased public defender rates. So they're rather specialized. And as the court touched on before, there are some, you know, procedural due process problems with that trial and at sentencing. And I focused on sentencing because that's where I felt most of that's where the problems arose, because the statements are used at sentencing and the state attempted to then want to use them at a subsequent trial. And I looked to what is the underlying purpose of both a court-ordered pre-sentence report or a report drafted as an alternative with the initiative of defense counsel. And I felt that they were both done to present information to the court. And that makes sense, because in moving from trial to sentencing, we have an opening up, so to speak, of the court. We go from very rigid rules of evidence to be interpreted by trial courts to sentencing, where tons of information can be brought in as to character, mental health, et cetera. And much, if not all, of that information could be provided on a hearsay basis or through self-reporting of the defendant. And in that respect, I looked at the purposes of sentencing to convey information. And that's how I looked at Heather Rowe's report in this particular case. And though I wrote in the brief that the problems arise when an individual defendant would not feel comfortable speaking with a state PSI author, a DOC employee is who I'm referring to, the same problem occurs if a defendant wants to amend his statements or remembers different facts or wants to just present more information in the alternative form. Then we have a statement in the court-ordered PSI deemed confidential. We have those same statements contained in a private memorandum and maybe some additional statements. And then we're talking about splitting hairs and what comes in and what doesn't come in. And does the admissions in the 972-15 report, even if they're not used to trial, do they set the table for further argument that, well, these other statements should come in as well? And I think the trial court in this case realized that the problems occur both at trial, at sentencing, and on the appeal process, because it seems to be a fairly hollow victory if you can proceed to appeal because of a procedural or constitutional error, and then when you come back after, well, to use the word victory, you're in a worse position than you were before.
Counselor, if the same statement by the defendant appears in a court-ordered PSI and a private PSI, you want to release both of them, but do you think that there's any difference in the analysis that we would look at? In other words, would we still have to go through the analysis you're giving us here for the private PSI if the same statement appeared in the court-ordered PSI?
If I'm understanding the court's question correctly, and
mm-hmm.
I think you would.
Okay.
Because the documents are both there to convey information, and I will be perfectly frank with the court, I am not ignoring my role as an advocate at all, and I understand that, just as I'm here today doing it. But in order to properly speak on behalf of my client, I need to speak, one, truthfully, both as an attorney, advocate, as an officer of the court. But I also need to have the people who work for me, those who are drafting the reports, I need them to be somewhat honest and objective as well, because I want the court to accept those pre-sentence memorandum, maybe not on equal footing with a DOC-authored report, but at least somewhere in the same ballpark. And I personally
counsel,
don't have as much...
Counsel, is there any claim here that the social worker who did this pre-sentence memo in any way led your client to believe that everything that was being said would be confidential? Was there any advice that what you tell me is confidential, anything of that nature that's being claimed here?
No, I have no information to indicate that Ms. Rowe provided any cautioning statements to Mr. Grieve. And if I could just for a moment turn to both Ms. Rowe's report and Dr. Thompson's report. Okay. Though I don't see it in Mr. Thompson or Ms. Rowe's report on quick examination, I know in reports that I've seen in cases that I've handled myself and in others that come to me on appeal, There are oftentimes from psychological evaluators or sex offender evaluators. There's a warning stated at the top of the document that the defendant was told that these statements are going to be used in court. There's no confidentiality. They're going to be passed on to the court. They're going to be, you know, given to defense counsel and probably disclosed to the state as well. So
you're saying there was no promise of confidentiality, but at the same time there was no warning that what was said could be used?
That's correct. There was no warning that these statements or promise that Mr. Grieve's statements would be confidential. None at all. And that kind of warning would run counter to the intent of the document itself, which is to convey as much information as possible, you know, in this particular case, risk assessments. And again, that would cause the defendant to have the same problem, possibly, as with a DOC author, meaning he's not comfortable speaking.
Could I ask you about some of the implications of a ruling in your favor? What about impeachment? Suppose certain statements are made in the document that you're trying to protect here, and then in a new trial the defendant gets up and testifies contrary to what he said in that document. What or she said? What are the impeachment implications?
Well, that's a difficult question, and I guess I would say that the statement shouldn't come in. Mr. Grieve's statements should not be used. And
he should be entitled to lie?
No, I don't think so. And I guess it would depend on the statements that we're talking about. And it's difficult for me to say that the statements, you know, should not be used against him. You know, to be perfectly frank, I don't know in that instance. And that has caused me some sleepless nights thinking about that particular question.
Well, let me give you another hypothetical, and I honestly have no idea what the answer is. Whether it's in the PSI or it's in the advocacy memorandum you're talking about, if a defendant hypothetically admitted to killing a person and then goes on and says, I also killed A, B, C, and D, can that information be used, or is there some sort of fruit of the poisonous tree here? I mean,
I think we're there. I would say that those type of statements, those additional statements, could not be used and should not be used. Then we're going to have to get into analysis of what level of detail was provided regarding those other statements. And are they able to be used as so-called other acts evidence under Witte?
You mean to say if a defendant went and committed a burglary, let's say, and in a PSI admitted, well, you know, Mr. Probation Agent, I also committed these four murders. The state is prohibited from going out and prosecuting those murders?
No. I think it poses a difficult question. I would say this, provide fodder for new or further investigation in those other crimes, absolutely. Are they prohibited from prosecuting those particular matters? No. Can they use Mr. Grieve's statements? If he were to take the stand, I think we get into some issues of, do you understand that, you know, at sentencing, I think we'd have to then provide some type of quasi-Miranda warning that, do you understand that these statements could be used against you in the future? And that's a little of the problem that we're dealing with here, is we have statements in a pre-sentence memorandum that we have from, if we look at State versus Watson says you're entitled to file them, in addition to a court order PSI, and being present at sentencing and all the other procedural safeguards we have, you're entitled to file these if you think that this report's going to contain true and accurate information. And then if we look at State versus Perez and State versus Mosley, both of those documents speak of pre-sentence memorandum as one of many due process procedural safeguards in place. So I understand some of the problems that occur, but we are talking about a due process problem that occurs at sentencing, on appeal, and at a subsequent trial to a successful appeal. I mean, we're having the shockwave and the ripple effect. And from both a due process standpoint, a sentencing standpoint, and a policy standpoint, we want to give courts as much information. And I think we should trust trial courts to be able to sift and winnow through the information that they have. I mean, there has to be a certain level of trust with everybody involved. If it's a defense attorney who's submitting a document, we have to trust that they're going to do the best they can to submit truthful and relevant information, knowing in the context of sentencing and knowing that it's probably going to contain some advocacy statements. But we have to trust that the judges have enough life experience and maturity to get through that stuff.
Is there another way of getting confidentiality here other than through not 972.15, really feed-offs of 972.15 and your comparison with the PSI? So I'm trying to explore there are other ways. For example, whatever he tells the lawyer, right, is confidential. So is this person, maybe the confidentiality is lost once the lawyer tells the court. Is that true?
I would argue that that's true.
So that even if you said that the person taking this pre-sentence memorandum would, once he tells somebody, it's gone, right? What about a psychologist or a psychiatrist? In a not guilty by reason of mental disease or disorders, you don't, if he tells something, it can't be used against him at trial, can it?
That there's actually a rule set out in 971.14 dealing with that issue, and it's, and you'll have to forgive me, I haven't taken a look at the statute a little bit. My recollection is that those statements to that individual are not allowed in.
What I'm trying to do is find, as Justice Prosser did earlier, analogies whereby information that's given to a third party, reported to the court, still retains its confidentiality in the sense of not being able to be used against him on guilt or innocence, because it's more important the court hear this information, then it be used later on guilt or innocence. I mean, I think that's the theory, and that's really what you're promoting, isn't it?
I am, but with a specific limitation.
Which is what?
Which is this. And this is what my argument was, and hopefully I've made it clearly. If not, I apologize. Which is, if a statement from a defendant is made to a third party for purposes of use at sentencing,
would you say that again and more slowly, please?
I'm sorry.
At sentencing rather than pre-conviction.
Correct. If the statement is made for purposes of use at sentencing, with that limited focus, I think that those statements would then be and should be deemed confidential. Because, as I started with, we're in a particular context of talking about statements that occurred at sentencing, and now we're here at the trial level after a successful appeal. But we're talking about what occurred at sentencing. So if a statement is just made to some friend, and the friend tells the defense attorney, hey, your guy told me he murdered 18 people. that is just my defendant not keeping his mouth shut when he probably should have. But if he makes a statement such as Tom Grieve did here in this particular case, and it's meant for use by a professional who's writing a report to be used at sentencing, then we have the nexus, we have the connection. And it's kind of like an A plus B equals C, where we want to convey the information. We need a defendant to speak truthfully and candidly in order to produce relevant information for the courts.
You don't, this case isn't about confidentiality. You're not asking for confidentiality because you want the court to know, right, all this information. What you're really asking for is immunity, right, against the use, against your client of these perfectly voluntary, perfectly trustworthy statements that came out of his own mouth in an interview with somebody on his side, not working for the prosecution, not a state actor. And I recognize that Crowell was a statutory interpretation case that focused on the statute's imposition of confidentiality on the court-ordered PSI, but it's really an immunity decision. It's saying that these statements are immunized from any future use against the defendant by virtue of the confidentiality of the document. But that's what this case is really about, immunity or some sort of privilege along the lines of a self-incrimination privilege, although you're arguing it's constitutionally based in due process. I don't hear you making a compulsory self-incrimination argument, nor could you.
No, no, and no, I don't think so. And whether is that, if you want to characterize it as immunity from use or if we want to characterize it as confidentiality, either of those statements are absolutely accurate. Sure, sure. In terms of intellectual honesty here today, sure, I have to admit that.
Right, and there really is no legal support for an argument against, or an argument in favor of some sort of use immunity in this context, is there? I'm hearing a lot of policy and a lot of, you know, it's a good idea, but I'm hearing almost zero law, and that's what I'm waiting for.
Okay. And my argument stems from, and let's talk about Crowell. Let's go ahead and do that. It's a statutory interpretation case, sure, but there's more in there than just strictly looking at statutory interpretation. I mean, I think the court does touch upon...
Not constitutional law, though. And you said you're not making a statutory argument here, you're making a constitutional due process argument.
Well, I think...
Back it up.
Okay. Well, I think the constitutional due process issue comes with the necessity of having all true and correct and accurate information. Okay. And to have that, we can have that through a number of avenues at sentencing. Statements from defense counsel as to what his or her client told him or her. An alternative pre-sentence memorandum. An allocution statement. Or statements in a report under 972.15. All of those are individual avenues to convey this information. And with the state's approach, what the state is saying is, let's have a vehicle that is in relatively common practice now, an alternative pre-sentence report. Let's have that, not have the same protection as a similar vehicle, a pre-sentence investigation report under 972.15. Due process is implicated because we're cutting off an avenue for communication from an offendant to a court. That's where the due process problem comes in. Now, a secondary due process problem is at subsequent trial to appeal. In Crowell, we had appeal, statements used, and then the case eventually reaches this court. We have the same situation here. We have successful appeal, a request to use that statement, and now determining how to treat it. If it's information that's being conveyed about the present offense, not speaking about some other offenses a defendant might talk about, but just talking about statements from a defendant about the particular offense, that's where due process is implicated, because then the defendant has to make a choice at trial, testify, not testify, depending on what this court would issue in terms of a ruling on whether or not some quasi-Miranda decision has to be gained. Moreover, he's damaged at trial because now the state is open to calling that expert who did the report, such as Ms. Rowe, and maybe not, a witness is gone, and now Mr. Reeves' statement is absolutely essential to have, or else there's no case.
But let's say that the defendant, after pleading guilty, has a heartfelt conversation with his minister, makes inculpatory statements, asks the minister to make a statement to the judge at the time of sentencing and mitigation of sentence, so he's waived any priest-penitent privilege. The minister comes, makes the statement. The guilty plea conviction is later overturned on a technicality by the appellate court. It comes back. The defendant wants a trial. would you argue that the state should not be entitled to call that minister to testify about the statements the defendant voluntarily made to him and waived the applicable evidentiary privilege?
That would be my argument, yes. And I would say that because this particular problem that we're faced with today comes up in multiple contexts, not just a statement by Tom Grieve to a social worker such as Heather Rowe, but to another professional or defense counsel himself. If defense counsel has said to the court, you know, my client has stated, you know, such and such in the state DOC authored report, but he's also told me X, Y, and Z about the offense, and I feel it's relevant for the court to have that information. Then the natural question is, defense counsel has come and talked in open court about something his client has told him.
Usually defense attorneys don't make sentencing arguments in that way, at least in my experience, and I've, you know, presided over thousands of felony sentencings. It's not my client told me X, Y, Z. It's, you know, here's some information about my client. He doesn't parrot or repeat what the client said in privileged, confidential attorney-client communications. That would be highly unusual. But the hypothetical that I posed might not be. And usually when we're talking about due process concerns about the admission of inculpatory statements against a defendant in a criminal case, we're talking about whether they're trustworthy, whether they're voluntary, and so forth. And there is nothing involuntary about these statements. There's nothing untrustworthy about these statements. So why shouldn't the jury have them, either in the state's case in chief or in impeachment?
Because
especially in impeachment.
I understand. And I think because the statements were made with a particular purpose. And
why should the defendant be allowed to call the shots that way? You can use my statements in mitigation of my sentence after my guilty plea, but you can't use them for any other purpose. That serves no public policy whatsoever. It certainly doesn't serve the truth.
Fair question. The public policy implications are that you're going to have communication stymied at sentencing. If a defense attorney with a minimum amount of common sense isn't going to tell their client, don't talk to an alternative pre-sentence writer about the offense. I see that my time is up. I don't know if the court wants me to continue.
I have one more question. If we would rule in your favor and say that this statement couldn't be used at trial, you're not asking us to say that if there's something else in that statement that could be used to develop evidence for trial. This is a sexual assault case, and say he talks to the private social worker and says, yes, I did this and this on Friday afternoon, and somehow that Friday afternoon statement is very helpful to the state in building their case for some other reason. You're not asking us to exclude everything that's in this report, just the statements that are admissions against interest, or is your request broader, that it's any statement defendant makes to the person preparing the report?
No. My argument to the court, because I represent Mr. Grieve, is just about his statements that were relevant to the present offense in the present case.
But I'm thinking about a statement that is relevant to the offense that is going to be retried on. And just say the state has a case to prove, and as all cases, you know, there can often be holes in them. And so now we say, well, you can't use his admissions against interest. And I guess what I'm asking you are you also asking us not to be able to use anything he said, like that the assault occurred on Friday, something that would help the state build evidence for this same crime from a third party? Do you understand what I'm
saying? I do understand.
Yeah.
No, I do understand what you're saying. And no, I'm not necessarily arguing for that.
Okay, so just the admissions against interest. Well, then you have to ask, I guess, what's an admission against interest, too. So anyway, okay.
Well, in this case, I don't know the facts here, but there were some other acts evidence that were admitted, I believe, in the sentencing memorandum. Is that right?
I believe so, yes.
Were they also admitted in the pre-sentence investigation?
I don't believe so. I think that there was more information contained in Ms. Rowe's alternative report than there was contained in the DOC report.
All right. Well, now may the state go after those other acts now and try to find, can they introduce those, that other act's evidence at trial?
If there was a new case that would, that developed? I think the answer would, at least on the spot, I think the answer would be yes, only because in this particular case, we're talking about statements to be used in a trial subsequent to a successful appeal, whereas in that other instance, we're talking about different criminal conduct, different case, and a different procedural position. So I think it's possible that an argument could be made that the state would be able to introduce those statements. Thank you very much.
Counsel, thank you. Ms. Campbell?
There exists no basis in law or statute for extending the confidentiality protections in 97215 to alternate pre-sentence memoranda.
How about public policy? You said that was the third argument being advanced here.
Yes, based upon public policy, there is no necessity for extending the confidentiality protections because the defendant already has an avenue by which he can convey any new information that he wants the sentencing court to consider to the sentencing court through the pre-sentence investigation that now exists. The
system. I look at page 869 of the Crowell case that sets forth the public policy reasons for not using the statements made by a defendant to the person who is conducting the investigation. So you got made by the defendant to the person conducting the investigation. And the court says several things there. It says what the whole policy is, the quality and accuracy at the top of the page of the pre-sentence investigation report depends in large measure on the cooperation of the defendant. And it goes on to say, and the defendant is encouraged to be open with the officer so that the sentencing court will be provided all the information. And it continues on to say, the defendant would be reticent if in giving full cooperation if he knew that this could be used against him. And finally, if this court were to allow a pre-sentence investigation report or probation parole officer's testimony about the defendant's statement to be used against a defendant after withdrawal of a guilty plea, or I assume after it's sent back on appeal, I'm sending that, inserting that myself, we would undermine the defendant's confidence in speaking freely and fully to the investigating officers. It seems to me that those policies that, and with those limitations that are set forth in Crowell, apply also from a public policy point of view to this case, having the case been reversed on appeal, and now we're trying the same thing.
The state agrees with the holding, but rights without responsibility is a contravention of public policy. Defense pre-sentence memoranda are not required to be neutral or objective, and in expert documents concerning pre-sentence memoranda, defendants are advised not to place in information that would harm their ultimate goal, which is mitigation of the resulting sentence. It's an unregulated advocacy piece. Therefore, it contravenes public policy to, in its current state, to extend confidentiality and use immunity protections to an advocacy document, barring the responsibilities that are now placed upon the pre-sentence investigation in 972.15.
Your opposing counsel makes an interesting argument that sounds like it rings true with me. This is an advocacy piece, no doubt about it.
Yes.
But you won't want it to be too much of an advocacy piece. You want it to have, if I'm sitting in Wausau as a circuit court judge and I have the public defender's office bring these in from their staff person who does these, they better smell to me at least being credible if you want it read. If it's too advocacy, it's a waste of my time because it's not helpful. It's just more stuff to read. And so, admittedly, it's advocacy, but in order to be the best advocate, you've got to be credible.
The omissions create a problem, however. In Mercia Sheen's piece that I quote within my brief in chief, she states that while when, for instance, one defendant's pre-sentence author found that the whole family was full of alcoholics and it was a DUI case, even though that would give background information as to why this person may have come to this point, that information was not and should not have been placed in the memo because it would be the risk outweighed the benefit as to far as to how the court might look at that, whereas a PSI author would include that information in their report based on the mandates of the administrative code. So therefore, the omissions are more concerning than just the information that's placed in, and it's placed in a favorable light. All of the people that love and have confidence in the defendant, their testimony would be placed in the memo, but such other damning information is not mandated by statute that the defense pre-sentence memorandum author placed that in. They have no regulations upon content at this point. And that is why it would be fundamentally unfair to extend use immunity and confidentiality protections to this advocacy document in absence of some accountability and restraint.
Thank you, Ms. Campbell. Thank you, Mr. De La Rosa, for your arguments about use of pre-sentence memorandum. That closes the hearing on 02-2332 CR, State v. Grieve, and concludes our arguments today. We are in recess until 9:45 tomorrow.